I'm Terrence McKnight, and you're listening to a special podcast from WQXR and WQXR.org. Every music fan loves a top 10 list, and hardly anyone can agree about what belongs on that list. Everybody has different opinions, including Anthony Tomasini. Tomasini is the New York Times chief classical music critic, and recently he put together a list of his 10 greatest classical composers of all time. His list included Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Schubert, Debussy, Stravinsky, Brahms, Verdi, Wagner, and Béla Bartók. So we're going to use this list as a springboard for a conversation. We're going to have a debate on the greatest composers of all time. So joining me here are three experts. Fred Plotkin. Fred is the author of several books on music and food. Well, he's got a book called Classical Music 101. Olivia Giovetti is here. She's the music writer for Time Out New York, Gramophone, and other publications. And we brought a composer to have this conversation. Jet Greenstein composes music. He's also co-director of New Amsterdam Records, a record label that specializes in contemporary music. I'd imagine these kind of lists come out, you know, periodically. Fred, I mean, is it important that we create these lists?
Well, no, actually, because it tends to limit rather than explain. But for people who want to put their toe into music, it's a good way to start. But obviously, I think we all looked at his list, created our own list, and realized how much we had to leave out. Now, one thing I want to add, you said we don't have to define the word great. We don't have to define the word music. We do have to define the word classical.
And uh-oh.
I use that as my point of departure to create my list, because the classical era, as we know it, began basically with Haydn. So therefore, I left out Bach, Handel, and Monteverdi, who are all giants, especially Handel. Not because they don't belong there, but not on a classical list.
Well, going back even further, I don't think that you can start talking about music until really you start, even before Hildegard von Bingen, but she was the first on my list chronologically. You know, even looking at opera, which was born in Italy, it was conceived in Mesopotamia with Syrian chant. So really, should we start there with these anonymous composers who gave us the foundations of music that Bach, Haydn, Mozart, even Stravinsky and David Lang built on?
What I like about the way that Fred is articulating this is that there's a specificity to it. And I think these lists are basically fruitless, but they become more fruitful the more specific you can become, the more you can define the terms that are actually in play. Though I would ask you, do you think that there have been no composers since the death of Strauss who have lived up to that historical standard?
Oh, absolutely. Without going into too much detail, unless you want, I started by coming up in my head with 32 composers. I should say I didn't read any of Anthony Tomasini's articles because I was abroad when all of this happened, and therefore used in my own head the concept of classical, wrote down 32 names of composers, and then started giving them numerical rankings based on their originality, on their orchestration, on their poetic gifts, on melody. And, for example, George Gershwin and Duke Ellington came out ahead of Richard Strauss for me. But in constructing the list, I went for other assumptions. But absolutely, people today can qualify and be described in the same way.
Now, I should say to our podcast listener that everybody's list, Olivia's list is on our website, Fred's list is on the website, and Judd's list. So you can see Anthony Tomasini's list as well as the list of all my guests. But when I first looked at Tomasini's list, it occurred to me that the greatest music has already been written because everybody on the list is dead. Am I off base?
No, not at all. My answer when I'm constantly asked why is there no good music or no good composers today is that the great people from the past are the people who did works at last. And in every creative era, whether it's visual arts or writing or music, theater, film, what is left to us are what have come to be known as the great works. And the great works are still being written today. But unfortunately for our composers, there's not the context to always recognize that. And I think that in the future, we'll look back at 2011 and say, wow, that was good music that was written back then.
Judd, you're a composer.
I, in fact, am.
Yes. And talk about your list.
Well, sure. I mean, the thing that I always wonder about the type of narrative that Fred's describing is how much of it is actually a response to what's there and how much of it is actually constructing that mythology as it's being spoken. And that's what I worry about as a composer, that the more we say, well, we can't evaluate the present until it becomes the past, we're simply making that the fact. We're simply saying, don't evaluate the present in the same terms that you use to evaluate the past. Don't put things from the present in with the past. And so when I made my list, I thought, what are the specific terms that would be interesting to evaluate composers in, not an objective sense, because you can never really be objective about this, but a specific angle that applies to music as a continually changing, dynamic, historical system. And so since I'm a composer, I thought, who are the most influential composers in history? Influential not just on listeners, but on composers themselves. Who are the people who have kept the system fresh and changing? And for me, that starts with Monteverdi.
So you're saying you don't have to start with Bach? You have to go before Bach to really to get that understanding of counterpoint?
Well, you can do whatever you want. I was thinking about who are the people who actually had the most substantial impact on the way that composers going throughout the rest of history thought about themselves. And there, I think Monteverdi, with the breadth of work that he brings to the table in so many different disciplines, in serving as a bridge between two different styles, much like Beethoven, actually, a couple of hundred years later, he seems like the first figure who actually towers over not just composition in his own time, but composition today.
So let's just, perhaps we can just take a quorum and see whose name shows up on everybody's list. Tomasini's got Bach. Does everybody have Bach?
No.
You don't have Bach, Fred?
Nope.
What?
As I said, I left him out because
that's
he wasn't
sacrilege,
classical.
Man.
No, no.
Oh, that's right.
And frankly,
right.
Between him and Handel, I would take Handel, and I know that's sacrilege, too.
Beethoven loved Handel. He always talked about Handel over Bach.
And Mendelssohn loved Bach. I see lines throughout musical history, which are fascinating to read, that some of the great composers look back to Monteverdi, others to Bach, others to Handel, and others to all three. But I'm guessed not in the Bachian line. I'm more in the Handelian, Monteverdian line.
Okay, so let's go to the classical period. Beethoven. Is that Beethoven's on Tomasini's list? Everybody has Beethoven on their list, right?
Absolutely.
Olivia, talk about why you put Beethoven on your list.
I think that Beethoven and actually, I can't take credit for this, but Jonathan Biss, the pianist, in commenting on his recital for Carnegie Hall, which includes Beethoven and a new piece by Bernard Rands, drew connections to them by saying that every composer that came after Beethoven has to reconcile himself to Beethoven, either in a complimentary way or in an adverse way. And I think with any piece that I listen to by him, I am greatly moved and find an enormous impact. And I think that if he had just written one of his 9 symphonies, he would still be a great composer for that specific symphony and any one of them, really.
Can I respond to that? I mean, I like that description. The thing that bothers me about a comment like Jonathan Biss's, though, is the thing that bothers me more generally about the construction of these sorts of lists, because saying something like composers have to respond to Beethoven, certainly Beethoven's a great person to respond to, and I respond to Beethoven in my own work, but you don't have to. There's a lot of different ways of being a composer, and I think as we move forward into the future, we're going to find that the heterogeneity of music explodes the notion of the easy canonization of anyone. And I think Beethoven will always be a great figure, but in some ways what this is doing is it's trying to keep the same people in the picture. It's trying to say, well, let's make sure that we check ourselves. We make sure that we don't bring too many new voices to the table. And that, to me, is a dangerous trend. It's something that can block the flow of actual development, not just in music or music history, but in culture and our society in general.
One thing about Beethoven and many composers is that they're saddled by the standard accepted biography. So he's raging, he's deaf, he's all that. But if we look at his music, the late things, the Diabelli variations have a lot of humor in them when he was completely deaf and very sick. I recently was studying some of his music from 1792, the early string music. There was no signs of deafness. He was a young man. He was 22. That music is so bright and fresh and comical, but also profound. And I think we see a lot of the roots of the Beethoven that we think about there, but without the heavy biography. And we have to separate composer biography from music when we listen to the music.
I disagree.
Well,
I don't think that you need to have the biography of the composer in mind when you're listening to the music, but I think it certainly helps, you know, when you understand the emotional impact that's going on in something like the Beethoven Violin Concerto or the Emperor Piano Concerto, you get a much richer meaning from it. It doesn't mean that you can't enjoy it on its own, but I certainly advocate having the context in mind when listening to it.
So it sounds to me, Fred, you're saying you can separate the art from the artist. And
not
Olivia.
That one can, but one should try at least initially. And that a first hearing of any piece of music of any type should be done purely as a sensorial experience without analysis.
You know, it makes me think about Wagner. I didn't start to question whether or not I should like Wagner until I knew his biography. I mean, just listening to his music, I thought, wow, this is beautiful, man. And then I learned more about Wagner, and I felt bad about enjoying his music so much. And I know some people feel that way about Miles Davis. If you look at some of the things Miles Davis did personally, you know, it might kind of influence the way you hear his music. But I want to get to this Mozart thing, because Judd, Mozart's not on your list.
He's not. It's appalling to have to say something like Mozart is not influential in the way these other composers are, because Mozart is obviously one of the most influential composers in musical history. I just didn't think he was quite as present a figure in the compositional life of today's composers. I mean, so it just breaks my heart, and probably Fred's and Olivia's as well, to think that, oh my God, my list doesn't have all these towering giants on it. But, you know, Mozart is he is a composer who is loved like practically no other by the people who love him. And that, in a different type of list, I think makes him absolutely one of the top 10.
So maybe this is a historical thing, just in terms of the way music was passed down and the roles that men and women had over the course of the last 500 years. But Hildegard of Bingen is the only woman on this list.
Meredith Monk.
So two out of, what, 40? We're looking at Tomasini's list and the three of yours. Olivia, as a woman, what does that say?
You know, when I was originally coming up with my list had many more women on it, but I didn't want to put a female composer on my list just by virtue of the fact that she was female. And it really came down to, for me, defining what makes it great or how these criteria are going to be established. Because honestly, I think that one of the greatest songs, if we're taking it in terms of popularity and in terms of something that is probably the most sung song in the world, was written by two women, two sisters from the States, which is Happy Birthday. You know, that song, I think, is one that echoes in, at least for the last century, has echoed in numerous cultures. And does that make it great, or is it something more complex in the music? You know, like I said, for me, Hildegard was a natural on the list because she really started to push song from just being plain chant into something I thought that was more complex and beautiful. And she also wrote in a very feminine way for the female voice as opposed to just the male voice, which was very much the case then. Going forward, I'm so glad you put Meredith Monk on the list, because that was one that I wanted to get on and just couldn't fit her in there.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, I think if we did this list in 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, I think it would change. Mm-hmm. And I hope it would change, better change. You know, I hope that what is considered a composer at that time also changes, both because of things that happen within the world of contemporary classical pedagogy and music in general, classical music in general, but also the way that we think about those lines between the world of classical music and other musics being melted away. And, you know, one of the people that I very nearly put on is Björk. She has exerted a huge influence on composers of my generation, because she was one of the first people who came from the pop world who started making music that felt like it was kin to the sorts of things that we were exploring. This is around the time, you know, when I was in college and grad school, and it was like this voice from the other side, literally and figuratively, that felt familiar and yet, of course, completely novel, unique and fascinating. And more and more people since Björk have been exploring things that I think you have to count in some way as composition. That's something that's of particular interest to me, but I think increasingly it's going to be of interest to the classical music world in general.
Music rests in the head. And when we're talking about Mozart and also about Happy Birthday, that's music that imprints in the head. And I think that ultimately what we're going to talk about is how it touches our heart and soul. Because we can analyze the notes, but we have to talk about the effect too, and I think you began to. But it's very important to realize that if we only study it, we're pushing away a big part of the experience.
You're listening to WQXR.org. This is a special podcast. I'm Terrence McKnight, and my guests are Fred Plotkin, Olivia Giovetti, and Jed Greenstein. We're talking about this top 10 list Anthony Tomasini has published. We're talking about, you know, composers and why we think they're important. Some of our WQXR listeners weighed in on this topic, and some of the names that kept coming up: Rachmaninoff, Chopin, Mahler, Tchaikovsky, Puccini, Dvorak. None of these names were on Tomasini's list, and I'm wondering what that says, where there's some kind of gulf between what Tomasini is thinking and what our listeners are hearing.
I think the names you just mentioned have in common that they're strong melodists. We know their melodies and we respond to them. And perhaps Anthony Tomasini looked for other factors in addition to melody. But I know that many people who claim to love certain kinds of music, for example, Puccini, say that they love his melodies. Puccini, in my 32 names that I went through, didn't even make the list. Rachmaninoff didn't either, and that was just an oversight. I think I would have looked at him. But Puccini, not to criticize too much, but he has a different effect. We love the melody. We identify with some of the characters. But I think Mahler had a bigger DNA imprint.
That's right.
And actually, Anthony Tomasini mentions Béla Bartók. He died on 57th Street in 1945, and he really had an impact mostly on musical students and musicians more than the general public.
I think this gets into the question of subjectivity. I mean, there's three big classical music fan types that I can think of that I think explain some of that. One is symphonic fans, one is piano fans, and then there's opera fans. And if you are...
Choral music fan. What about choral?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's a million others. And there's new music fans. And probably some people are going to look at my list and be like, well, he's just a new music fan because he's a composer. But, you know, that if somebody was really just interested in 20th century music only, then they would make a completely different list. And if you are a fan of piano music, you are not going to leave Frédéric Chopin off that list. Dvorak, obviously, is, for people who are subscription orchestra goers, one of the top names. You're just going to hear him all the time. But if you're somebody who's more of a fan of chamber music, yes, he wrote it, but it's not really deemed as significant as his orchestral output.
Olivia.
As a classical music writer or a journalist of classical music and a devotee of classical music, you know, one of the composers that probably gets played the most in our house, especially with company, is Mozart. And, you know, when you were talking, Judd, about the different groups and the different devotees, I think that Mozart applies equally to all of them.
I guess what I want to know is, when we take music out of the scope of being a spectator sport, when we step outside of the concert hall where we're just, you know, watching or listening, the way music functions in our life, does that change our list? I mean, it's Saturday morning. I kind of like listening to the blues on Saturday morning. It kind of helps me clean my house.
I would clean if I cleaned to Rossini, because that would get me up and running and really pushing that broom around the house and rattling the pots. But other music is for different moods, and I think that we sometimes recognize the mood we're in and reinforce it with music that we select. But if we flick on the radio and hear music that we didn't plan on hearing, we respond to what we're hearing purely through sound and often through words.
You know, I heard Robert Spano say one time, he said, people always ask me, you know, Robert, who's a great composer? And I say, whoever you have on your iPod. That if it's great to you, then it's great.
I think part of the problem with creating a top 10 list is that for a lot of people, it tells them where to stop rather than where to start. And again, that's sort of detrimental, where we want people to listen to as much as they want to. Someone may look at my top 10 list and not like any of them, but that doesn't mean that they're not going to like some form of classical music. I think also stripping it of its academia and of this idea of greatness would also help. When this first article came out, I was reminded of that scene in Dead Poets Society where they're reading the essay on how to make a poem great and scoring it on these X and Y axes. And it feels the same way, where if you're qualifying or quantifying greatness, it can get very dry very quickly. And people who are listening to music don't want to necessarily have that deep academic experience. Honestly, Ives is on my list, but most of my friends do not want to listen to Ives if they're listening to classical music. They want to listen to Puccini.
I think you raised a very interesting point. I don't know if you intended to. What struck me was, if you were to ask me my favorites, my list does not contain my – it contains one of my favorites, and I won't say which, but Hector Berlioz. But I think if you were to ask anyone to construct a list of, let's say, 10 musicians, not composers, whose music says this is who I am, that would be a, that would be more autobiographical. And it's not about favorites, but expressing things that are components of our character. So if I were to give you a few of mine, they would definitely include Berlioz, but also Duke Ellington, but also Mick Jagger, Keith Richards right in there, and also Ella Fitzgerald, and also Handel. And it's all, that's all part of me, Rossini as well.
See, a list like that tells me so much more than any of these lists. Mm-hmm. I just learned who you are in a way that I haven't this,
and
the course of this entire...
And you still like me? Or?
I like you. I do.
Good, thank you.
I liked
I'm
you before.
Starting to. I'm...
I mean, I think that it gets back to what Terrence was saying about function, because we all have different functions in our lives that we need music to fulfill. And what this does is it says, here are a lot of people that you're probably going to go to in very similar circumstances when you want similar things. And it may seem to people who are listening to this, who only listen to classical music, that this is a that's a preposterous statement, that these actually have, you know, completely different voices. But and of course they do. But if you look at it in the broader context of all the music that's in the world, they're very similar in certain ways, and the kinds of places that you're going to hear them, the kind of the way that the music is recorded, and any way that it's going to get to your ears is going to have a lot in common with the way that the other composer's music gets to your ears. And when we, when I ask somebody, what is your, you know, give me your top 10, just the things that you love the most, it tells me about the course of their life. I can picture them. I can hear through their ears what they need from music. And that's a really exciting thing because it brings music back into a more relevant and prominent role in our lives.
Do you all think it's worth our time to talk about the top 10 worst composers? No. All right. Well, thanks for coming in. Why not, Fred? Why not, man?
Well, because life is too short and time is too precious. And there's so much good and beautiful and wonderful and new that we can explore. But if we said that Liszt, for example, is not a good composer, which a lot of people say on his bicentennial, I think we're eliminating all the good that he did and all the impact that he had. And therefore, Liszt would not be on my worst list at all.
That's right. I mean, we wouldn't have that Beethoven statue if it were not for Franz Liszt.
We wouldn't have Wagner's wife.
Wow. Why'd you go there?
Because Liszt was Wagner's father-in-law. And that is a phenomenal story unto itself.
And the way Wagner survived. Hans von Bülow was like dedicated to this dude even after all. Amazing.
And thousands of women.
Fred Plotkin is my guest. Olivia Giovetti is my guest. Judd Greenstein is my guest. You're listening to a special podcast on WQXR.org. I'm Terrence McKnight, and we'll do it again next time. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.